There's no place to escape to.
This is the last
podcast. On the left.
From your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
You're a dirty dog. You need a bath, you big stanky dog.
This is the worst.
Bark at me. Bark at me.
Bark. Doggy. Bark.
All right. Welcome to the last podcast on the left, everyone. I am Ben, hanging out with Marcus and Henry. I have no idea why they chose to start the show like that, but great. Great.
Ruff, 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 ruff.
We are so happy for this episode. We are excited. This episode is a conversation with Harold Schechter and Eric Powell. It's all about their new book, Did You Hear What Eddie Gein Done? It's a graphic novel. It's freaking kick-ass. And this conversation, I think you're all going to really enjoy it.
What I think is key about what we talked about and this new graphic novel is that Harold Schechter has brought a new layer of research to the Eddie Gein story. And his take is fascinating. What he talks about, the stuff that he has come out of it, and then the stuff that he's come out with is really interesting. And I really feel like we did a good job in the interview kind of really talking about more general questions about Ed Gein. And there's new shit out there about
him.
I will endorse this book wholeheartedly. Woo! It is fantastic. Not only is Eric Powell's art just on point, but Harold Schechter introduces some new ideas about Ed Gein that have never been heard. I mean, it's a case that is decades upon decades old that we've been talking about for decades, that he has a new perspective on it, and that's incredibly hard to do. And the way that Eric Powell has illustrated those new ideas is phenomenal. I cannot buy this book. Buy this fucking book.
And we're not even getting paid. This is no money. No, to us. We have no skin in this game. This is literally just, it's nice to see two people who know what the fuck they're doing make something that's highly interesting.
Yeah, I just want you, the listener, to read something cool. Go check it out.
And don't worry, I did directly confront Mr. Powell about his use of the word goon. Because, wow. All right, everyone. Well, please enjoy this interview again. This is Harold Schechter and Eric Powell discussing their new book, Did You Hear What Eddie Gein Done? Thank you guys so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
You guys got together, this is a collab, to work on a new graphic novel entitled Did You Hear What Eddie Gein Done? Which is such a freaking kick-ass title. So what brought you guys together?
Well, Eric brought us together. So Eric reached out to me through my agent. You know, I'm a lifelong fan of comic books. I had assembled.
And of course, Eric Powell, the great mind behind The Goon, a very famous comic.
Yeah, which is sweet.
Although I do take a little offense to the name, but that's okay.
That's because it's been a slur for Kissel's people for a long time.
Sorry about that.
Well, you know, Eric, who is very modest, I think overly modest, always demurs when I say that he's a genius. But, you know, he's one of the great comic book artists of our generation.
I've been reading The Goon since issue one came out when I was in college on the Dark Horse run. I'm a gigantic fan of The Goon. This is so cool. Yeah. Like, and the fact that you two are working together, it's a match made in heaven.
It's like,
it's a
dream.
That's the way I feel.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just reading this article in the Hollywood Reporter where, Eric, you're quoted as talking about Mr. Schechter as one of your heroes as well. You talk about when writing this book, when you were approached to write this book about Ed Gein, you say, and when my favorite true crime author and Gein expert Harold Schechter enthusiastically agreed to work with me on a project, it was a dream or nightmare come true. The best part is we have a really unique take with in-depth information. So when it comes to you guys adding both of your information streams, how did that affect the story of Ed Gein and your guys' professional opinions?
I kind of came to it. I had the idea that I wanted to do something dealing with Gein's isolation and how that, you know, no one really knows what went on in that house other than Ed Gein. But being a huge fan of Harold, I didn't think I could do anything better than what he had already done in Deviant. So, I contacted him, in the hopes that he would you know, maybe want to collaborate, because I thought in the time since he had written it, he had probably, you know, more information had probably come to him. I just thought the idea would be, you know, a lot of fun to work with. I had no hopes of him actually responding to reaching out.
That's nice though.
Right.
But like he said, he's a huge comic book fan. So he was well aware of my work, and we just kind of went from there. And he was actually terrible to work with. I mean, just ego gone wild.
Diva. That's the first thing ever. I look at him as a diva. You guys can't see at home, but Harold on the Zoom is currently wearing what I can only assume is a pure gold lamé skin tight bodysuit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a captain's hat. And I can visibly see his nipples.
Woo! So
this is incredible. Honestly, it's nice to see, Harold. I've never seen your body like this.
Well, thank you. I very much appreciate that.
Well, speaking of, you know, to how much, you know, Harold loves comics, and obviously how much you love comics, and talking about like Ed Gein's Isolation, one of my favorite sequences in the book is Ed Gein imagining himself as a pulp hero, like an old timey pulp hero. Like, whose idea was that to kind of go into Ed Gein's twisted imagination?
Well, that particular sequence, pure Eric.
I think that was a little bit of both of us.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I can't remember.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the collaboration was interesting. I mean, you know, I wrote out my part of the story as a kind of movie script. Then I sent it to Eric. We went back and forth. You know, originally we had slightly different ideas of what kind of story we wanted to tell. But, you know, throughout the collaboration, we would consult and, you know, arrive at a common sense of exactly what we wanted to do. So, but, you know, I mean, Eric does such an amazing job of visualizing the ideas we came up with. So.
When you going back into the world of Ed Gein, this is for Harold, like now that you spend years working on Deviant, and now it's like, did you like put Ed Gein away and then like kind of come back? And what was it like going back into his world?
You know, well, I haven't totally put him away, you know, over the years, you know, because of my having written Deviant, people have asked me about it and spoken. You know, I've actually given a lot of thought to why Gein exerts such fascination, you know, but also the nature of, you know, of his madness. You know, I became increasingly dissatisfied with a kind of simplistic Oedipal explanation, that had, you know, always been offered at the time. You know, when Gein was, you know, when his crimes were discovered, that was the heyday of all this Freudian analysis. So naturally, you know, it ended up being all about his mother, who, you know, did play a big part in it.
I mean, he wore her like a dress, so she's got to be in there somewhere.
Yes, yeah,
he did wear her specifically.
No. But he tried, you know, he did try to dig her up. So, yes, guy definitely, he definitely had mommy issues. No question about that. You know, but I come to think with Gein and some other notorious serial killers, I don't regard Gein as a serial killer, but somebody like Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, there was a weird religious ritual aspect to what he was doing. And I'd come to believe that something in his psychosis almost caused a rupture in his psyche that caused all this kind of archaic religious stuff to emerge. And, you know, what he was really doing in his remote, isolated, ramshackle farmhouse was kind of performing these archaic rituals having to do with flaying victims. And, you know, if you look at a lot of stuff he was doing, it's the kind of thing that, you know, a lot of Aboriginal tribes people do, you know, in terms of keeping trophies, you know, shrunken heads and so on and so forth. Anyway, over the years, I didn't really think about that when I was writing Deviant, but I have been thinking more and more about it. And so, you know, we were able to work that into the graphic novel. Again, Eric did this amazing job of bringing it to visual life. You know, it's one of the things actually I'm happiest about the novel.
It's the it is the standout portion of the graphic novel is this idea of Gein tapping into some sort of like collective tapping into the collective unconsciousness and bringing in all. Are you, Harold? Are you have you been a big believer in the collective unconsciousness?
Absolutely. Not everybody knows this about me, but my scholarly background. You know, I did my PhD, a Jungian analysis of American literature. When I was doing my, I was very involved in the Jungian world for a while. I corresponded with Joseph Campbell, for example. You know, I took part in some major Jungian conferences. You know, I wrote a couple of books employing Jungian psychology, often to works of popular art. So yeah, that's always been part of my intellectual background.
Yeah. I want to talk with Eric here for a second, going back to what Marcus was talking about regarding the scene with Ed Gein fantasizing about himself as a pop icon. Did he have any ability to have anything like foresight? Do you think he saw himself as anything other than what he was? Was he that complex to understand what he was doing was going to be remembered?
Well, through the reference material that Harold dug up, you know, he did have the psychologist. I don't have an exact reference, but the psychologist did say he had a skewed kind of elevated sense of himself. So I think there had to have been something in there that, you know, he fantasized himself being a little bit more substantial than he was. You know, he was.
Well, when you think about Ed Gein, you almost think of Levon Helm. He's the old dirt farmer of serial killers, right?
He seems like
a very humble Wisconsin guy. Right. So that aspect of him being self-aware, digging up a grave, being like, they're going to remember this. Like that adds another layer of true deviancy to steal Mr. Schechter's term.
Because it does feel like he felt like the simpleton, right? I like this idea of that he was a lot more complex than he was just this guy like, I just like to make crafts. Like, no, he had like a whole series of layers.
I think there was some vengeance that definitely went into his acts, you know, when it comes to some of the graves that he chose to rob. But I'm not sure that he thought about anyone finding out about it.
Was vengeance in the grave robbing? So he would specifically grave rob out of spite?
Yeah, he mentions a time when someone had took some money from him or something, or someone had slighted him, so he dug up that person's mother.
So I
took that as an act of some kind of act of vengeance.
And it's almost like an act of vengeance towards his own mother as well, because his mother had been buried with, she had specifically requested there be a gigantic concrete block placed over her grave so he could never dig her up. He he never had the ability to dig her up.
Right.
And he always dug up women that looked it was always very much like his mother. Like, you know, the two women that he killed were very much like his mother, at least physically.
Yeah. Well, I think the psychological line on Gein was that his crimes express this ambivalence he had about his mother. You know, he worshipped her, but on another level, he obviously hated her and had all this homicidal fury. So he was both trying to reconstitute her, but at the same time, obviously performing these atrocities on her body. By the way, I would say to me, Gein reminds me, or what I think about in terms of Gein, is not so much Levon Helm's dirt farmer. I'm just writing about this. Somebody, it's like, I always think of him as like the citizens of Mayberry have just discovered that Barney Fife was a cross-dressing homicidal psycho.
He probably was.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Live from your grave.
We just did a documentary. Kissel and I were doing like talking head stuff for a Jeffrey Dahmer documentary. And it was really interesting going back through our material to like go talk to not sound like total fucking morons on the documentary. I was like going back through and I kind of refound myself like sympathizing with Jeffrey Dahmer. Like I ended up like going through his stuff and kind of seeing how like, obviously, he's a monster, but then I started to see his, like, humankind. Did something like that happen when you go back to, like, really spelling out and drawing Ed Gein's life, like, is there a sympathy there, or like, do you see the humanity more, or does he become more of a fucking alien?
And to piggyback on Henry's point, I'm just looking at the title here. Well, you call him Eddie Gein, and of course, Eddie is a sensitive, it's a, kind of a term of endearment in a way.
To me, it also was a nod to his childlike nature. You know, he was really kind of stunted as a person. So that's why I liked using the term Eddie. But I think I couldn't have done the book if I couldn't have a certain amount of compassion, you know, for him and what he went through. And, you know, he was definitely a diseased mind for sure. But I you can have some sympathy for him for the way he was raised and the isolation he lived in, and that, you know, contributed to him committing these crimes. But I think through the research, I actually started to have a little bit less sympathy as I went along because of his attempts to lie in a very childlike way to push the blame to someone else. So he never accepted his own, fault in any of these incidents. So
yeah, and also like when you go back and research some of those, especially like the earlier books written about Ed Gein before Deviant, some of the ones that I found are not sympathetic in any way whatsoever. They're very harsh. And a lot of them, and some of them are very trashy. We'll like to speculate of like, actually, he probably killed more like 10 or 15 people, you know, that go way in the other direction.
Well, I mean, I find it easy to feel a certain amount of sympathy for Gein.
Is it because of your collection of human artifacts and the partly dress you wear of made of female breasts? I've seen it. Honestly, it's very ornate.
It's really nice. It's really nice.
Just lucky I'm wearing my gold lame. So, people are always asking me, in fact, very recently with the book about becoming out, you know, how does Ed Gein compare to other serial killers? And my answer is, you know, that Gein was not a serial killer in the strict sense of the term. Deviant, that phrase never appears. The term serial killer, when it first entered the language, was used to describe these sadistic lust murderers, you know, Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy and so on and so forth, Edmund Kemper. You know, Gein wasn't a sadistic sex killer. He murdered these two women. We're not condoning that, you know, but they were executed, you know, very, very swiftly. He basically just needed them as raw material for his, you know, do-it-yourself projects at home. So, you know, he was essentially a necrophile in the grip of these very dark compulsions. It's impossible to feel sympathy for Albert Fish.
yes, that's the one you can't. That's the one that he's beyond the pale of all of them.
Yeah, but you can't feel sympathy for Bundy or Gacy either. No. But Gein is in a, well, you know, he's sui generis. He's in a category all by himself. So
what is it that Gein reflects about society that make him sympathetic?
What does he reflect about?
Yeah,
society?
Why is he sympathetic? I mean, he killed two people. He's a grave robber. He wore his mother's vagina. Why is he still somehow?
He never wore his mother's vagina. He didn't have anything to do with his mother's.
He wore his mother's
genitals.
Vagina. I'm just gonna say because you can't prove me wrong, even if you can. But, you know, all of that macabre, disgusting stuff aside, you're right. There is something sympathetic about him, but what is it?
I'm partly what I'm saying is relative.
It's like how Casey Anthony is a 10 if you take into account all women who killed their children on that level.
She's a 10
Casey Anthony is a 10.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, look, I mean, he was this pathetic figure. Again, in the grip of this very, very bizarre ritualistic compulsion, most of his victims were corpses that did not suffer at his hands. And you can feel sympathy with him just for the incredible, look, this is a guy who like the best thing that ever happened to him was when he was put in a mental institution.
That look on his face, that one picture of him like in the mental institution where he might as well be at Disneyland. Like he is so happy to finally have a bed.
Yes, exactly. So anyway, So that's
well, you know, feeling. Eric, maybe you can talk about that when it comes to animating someone like Ed Gein. What kind of properties or character traits do you look to accentuate when you're, doing something that I can't, now that we've dabbled in the comic book world, I can't believe what people can do because I can't draw a stick figure. But what do you look for?
There were little things I tried to do to make it sell an atmosphere or a feeling about the character. And definitely when in relation to his mother, I always had her kind of looming over him taller than him. In every scene, I try to never make them the same height and I went to extremes on that, especially during the segment with his childhood where I had him, inches high and she's just looming over him.
Yeah. I mean, the scene of like the way you put the famous scenes, the famous Ed Gein scenes, like the one that I think about most that was just so perfectly done that really put the Augusta as such a towering figure is when Ed sees them slaughtering the hog, which is when, as he's a child, like back in the back shed, like her towering over is like almost like more than a monster, but a god.
Right.
You're setting that up. It's wonderful. It's
that's
beautiful.
So brilliant.
Yeah, that's all from Harold. Like he was speaking earlier about the collective consciousness and everything. And one of the great things in collaborating with this book is I had a simple idea that I thought would be great. And then when we were first collaborating and trying to figure out the direction we wanted the book to go, he's telling me these ideas that he has, and I wasn't sure that I was grasping where he was wanting to take it. So it took a little while for me to get on board. Then as it started to sink in where he was going, I got really excited about it.
And, what were some of the ideas initially where he brought it up to you and you were like, Mr. Schechter, you are insane. Like, what's wrong with you? Am I safe? Where's the door? How do I get out of this room? What was an idea where you're like, I have no idea.
Well, just the godlike comparisons of the mother and how he worshipped her as a god. It wasn't quite clicking with me until we discussed it a little bit more. And now it's, like you said, it's the best part of the book. So that was definitely the biggest example of trying to,
illustrate his fear and love of exactly. Mommy. That's really awesome, man. That's brilliant.
Harold, I have to ask a question. You, I'm not going to call you a no fun fanny.
Whoa!
Right? I'm not going to call you this.
Shots fired. He's a guest in our house, Henry. This is a Shock Radio.
He tried to take H.H. Holmes from us. Right.
What?
Harold Schechter has some revisionist ideas that H.H. Holmes, which I'm with you, that he didn't kill as many people inside of his murder hotel as, right? Like, you think that it was like, that's exaggerated, right?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Now, when it comes to Ed Gein, this is in your research now, like re-getting in, do you think Ed Gein had anything to do with killing his brother or like being there? Like, do you think that was that just negligence or was that like a plan?
That's a tough one, but if I were really pushed to give an answer, which I obviously am at this moment.
On spotlights on you. Spotlight. This is it. Yeah.
I think he probably did not kill his brother.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't think he killed any of the other people that he was accused of killing. Again, he wasn't, he killed Bernie Swarden, he killed Mary Hogan. Again, he was running out of corpses in the local cemetery. He needed to renew his supply of overweight, middle-aged women so he can, again, go about doing his, his home improvement jobs.
Right.
So again, he went and executed them and so on. But no, I don't think he killed his, it just doesn't seem like his MO that he would kill Henry.
Do you think it's possible that he watched him die? That he could have saved him and just simply didn't?
Well, anything's possible. No. You know, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for giving us this, Harold.
Do you think it's
bad? I mean, you know, I mean,
breaking news. Harold Schechter says anything is possible.
Well, you know, I mean, if he wanted to kill, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, he could have killed Henry in any number of ways. You know, the fact that Henry died under those particular circumstances, which were circumstances, you know, in which other people had died in similar ways, you know, leads me to believe that Gein probably did not kill him. But at the same time, you know, it's entirely possible that he did not exactly regret that Henry had died, because again, then he had Augusta all to himself. So.
Oh my, and who doesn't want Augusta all to themselves?
Well, so I mean, do you, so I guess the whole thing with Henry, I mean, was that just sort of the small town rumor mill? Because that's one of the things that I love about the book, is that it really does capture the small town rumor mill that created the Ed Gein legend as we know it.
Well, I mean, what I've discovered in researching a number of books, including one that I published recently, you know,
plug it,
Rich. Oh. Wonderful book called Maniac, about the Bath School disaster of 1927, the Worth School massacre in U.S. history. But, you know, after the guy whose name was Andrew Kehoe blew up the school, there were all these stories arose that he'd been responsible for killing his stepmother. His stepmother had died years before when a gas oven exploded. You know, after Kehoe committed this atrocity, you know, everybody started talking about how he had killed his stepmother. I mean, that happens a lot, you know, where, you know, again, retrospectively, these killers are accused of all these crimes that they didn't commit. So, you know, that's my best guess about Henry.
Yeah, it turns from he probably did it to he did it once it goes from person to person to person.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's definitely a good time to be a serial killer if all of a sudden you find out there's a grave robber next door and you're like, I think the heat's off.
Yeah, somebody's creepier than me.
Exactly.
One more question for Harold about, like, just obviously conjecture. Eric, too, please chime in on this, because now you're in the Ed Gein world. You're now in this shit, too. You've experienced all of this.
He's drawn his penis.
What do you think
would
happen? What do you think would have happened if he wasn't caught? Like, do you think that, like, he would have just continued on in his little world, or do you think that he would have really had to go and search for bodies? Because I do, that is interesting, the idea of he is just a practical, quote-unquote practical killer, where it's just about art supplies.
Right. I think he would have, I think it would have escalated. I think he would have killed more people. I think he was very comfortable with the fact that he killed Mary Hogan in the tavern and got away with it so much that he told everyone that she was at his house. And
she's at my house right now. Eddie.
So I think if that had happened with Bernice Worden, then he would have been more emboldened to find other victims when he couldn't find a fresh grave.
Hmm. Well, he wasn't a clever criminal.
No, like, he's not at all.
He's not a powerful kind of predator type like a Ted Bundy or somebody like even John Wayne Gacy. Their new Peacock documentary actually really focuses in how much of a predator he was. Ed Gein was just kind of dumb.
Yeah, Harold, what do you think? What would have happened to Ed, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see him, you know, all of a sudden stopping his necrophiliac activities, and possibly again when he ran out of available corpses, killing other women. Although, you know, it's hard to know how many middle-aged, stout women in the community who reminded him of his mother there were.
It was Wisconsin. He was going to be just fine. And I say that with all the love in the world. But doesn't that then, because Harold, you said he wasn't a serial killer, but now you're saying he may have continued on killing if he wasn't caught. So then why not just call him a serial killer if you think he would have continued on?
You know, I'm kind of a purist when it comes to the term serial killer, in the sense that
he's a Lustmore type of guy.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Exactly. So you saw like Mindhunter and stuff, right? You know, all those you know, FBI profilers who were trying to get a picture of the psychology of these people. You know, they were talking to Edmund Kemper and people like that. In other words, the phrase was specifically used for these compulsive sex murderers who got their, you know, ecstatic orgasmic pleasure from torture, overpowering and torturing these helpless victims. You know, that was not Gein. In other words, what I'm saying is, like, to me, it's not just like a quantitative thing.
Sure.
You know, it's like contract killers aren't serial killers. Mm. I mean, they kill a bunch of people. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes. So, it's a job. You know, that's,
okay.
Yeah. So, you know, that's why I don't, in that sense, I don't regard Gein as a serial killer.
Interesting.
Live from your grave.
Now, that actually, I was wondering about that because I actually don't remember from our research, Ed Gein's crimes did have sort of a sexual nature, or did he not brought to orgasm by his stuff, or was it really just him moving through this ritualistic behavior?
It's a moment of contention. There's a tiny bit of contention about that.
Hmm.
Well, I'll let Eric answer in a minute, but my own. So the way I think about it, you know, in my book, I have a deviant, I have a chapter on necrophiles, famous necrophiles. And there are a couple of very famous French necrophiles, including this guy who's known as Sergeant Bertrand. And he would dig up the corpses of these, you know, young women and have sex with them, you know, which is classic necrophilia.
Really?
I think of that
as a vintage.
Yes.
Are
I
they
think
still?
Of that as a,
yeah.
Now, I think of that as a very American necrophile. In other words, he wasn't, you know, like Bertrand was like Pepe Le Pew or something. Necrophile. you know, Ed basically would, you know, take these corpses home and do home improvement projects with them. You know, I mean, he wasn't so much interested in having sex with them. You know, whether he might have attempted, I mean, he claimed that he didn't have sex with them because they, quote unquote, smelled too bad.
Oh.
You know, which suggested he might, the thought might have crossed his mind.
Oh, yeah. Maybe a little Axe body spray would have changed the whole mood.
I mean, serious question. Was he an emotional necrophile? Like, where people have physical affairs and emotional affairs, like, was it necrophilia for him a purely emotional thing?
You know, digging up female corpses, bringing them home, putting them in your bed. I mean, there is an erotic element to it. No mm-hmm. doubt. But my feeling is, and again, who knows, that it might never have gotten to the point where he was actually trying to consummate the relationship with the corpse.
Lucky guy. Eric, this is really going to be a hard-hitting question. When it comes to drawing an orgasm face, how do you do that? How do you capture the uncomfortability mixed with the exaltation mixed with the, like, oh, no. Oh, marry those.
It's not an easy task. And on top of that, you tried drawing an orgasmic face wearing a skin mask.
I mean, I'd go and get some ham at the store. I'd set up a mirror and I'd just kind of pace it around and just go, oh, oh, trying to make vulnerable noises.
Yeah, I think I disagree with Harold on this one, though, that I believe that he was a straight up necrophile just based on the way that he lied when he was being questioned. Like I said, it was very childlike and evasive and strategically evasive. And if you go through and read his some of his questioning, where he says, like, you know, they keep hounding him about some of these topics, and he goes, well, I did try, but I wasn't successful. And then the questioner is like, are you saying you didn't reach orgasm? And he's like, oh yeah, that's it, I didn't reach orgasm. Mm, and then and then he voluntarily adds, you know, when they ask him about Mary Hogan, he says, they said, so did you try with Mary Hogan? He's like, no, I never did that. That I can remember, you know.
Oh, he may have gotten too many PBRs going with the old Dahmer defense.
So, I mean, my opinion, and this is kind of the way we went in the book, was that, you know, just from his evasiveness and the way he answered the questions, I personally come to the conclusion that he was straight up using these bodies for sex. But again, like Harold said, who's to know? Again, you right. know.
This is, I want to ask this question as a general question to the group about serial killer confessions, because I think that that's a thing. It's a theme in Last Podcast on the Left, and we've been talking about it for years, just interpersonally. The idea of, why do some serial killers make shit up to fuck with people? Like, technically, we could say that Ted Bundy's after career, his post-prison time, was a lot of him spinning yarns. Same thing with Henry Lee Lucas.
Yeah.
Right. He's a confession killer. He basically said, yeah, I killed all of them. I did all of this horrible shit. But then why are there some serial killers like, I'm just going to say Ed Gein, but I know for today he's not, but like Ed Gein or like other people that are ashamed to say their most dark secrets, like that there's something about that where, like, I do feel like there's something about the relationship with him, with Ed Gein, and to the dead body, that he almost felt like it's a kiss and tell scenario and he doesn't want to do it,
and they're not going to tell.
That's the best part. I mean, well, for him,
I mean you know, my answer, a partial answer, is that as I'm sure you know, I mean, it's characteristic of a lot of serial killers that they have this megalomania, which, you know, I think it's a reaction against having been made to feel like shit when they were growing up, you know, so they, you know, part of the whole satisfaction they get from the crime, you know, is a sense of this power they wield. It's one of the reasons they taunt the police and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, I think that bragging about, you know, the number of people they killed and what amazing, you know, world-class killers they are and how they've outwitted law enforcement for so long, you know, is part of the gratification of the crimes. And then, you know, when you were talking before about Jeffrey Dahmer, I mean, one of the things that to me has always made him, if not totally sympathetic, but again, not as irredeemably evil as somebody like Ted Bundy, you know, is that when he was captured, he did seem to feel genuine remorse. And, you know, I think he effectively committed suicide because, you know, he asked not to be put in isolation in prison. He knew he was going to be killed. So
he was caught in a cycle that he couldn't understand. He couldn't get out of. And then he just kept going and going. It seemed to be a relief that when he was caught.
Yes, well, exactly.
Well, so, building off of that question, you know, is Ed Gein a psychopath?
Well, I mean, supposedly, you know, he was psychotic, not a psychopath, according to the shrinks who, you know, who examined him. You know, he was having these various hallucinations, visual hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, olfactory hallucinations.
Do you think that's real and not a story that he was telling? Do you think he was really seeing these things?
I think there was some element to that. Yeah, I do think he was probably, you know, again, his, you know, with Psycho, everybody came to believe that schizophrenia meant, you know, you have a double personality, but, you know, schizophrenia means you have a shattered personality.
Right.
And, you know, I think partly it was that shattering of Ed Gein's psyche that allowed all that primordial, weird religious stuff, you know, ritualistic stuff to emerge and take over. So,
well, I mean, you bring up Psycho, Harold, and I want to talk with Eric here because in this article that I'm reading, you talk about, you know, every kid who grew up in the 80s told stories about the 1950s ghoul, but it seems like the 1950s ghoul is still talked about today. We have stories like Luca Magnotta. We hear about horrible atrocities happening all the time. We do a show called Side Stories every week. People are getting dug up, and God knows what happens to everyone. They're having sex with stuffed animals, some of these people. Yeah. But do you ever think we're going to get into the lore that we have around the 1950s, around the 1960s, that era of true crime, nostalgia, the mystique around it? Do you think we're ever going to see anything like that again?
I'm not sure. It's like World War II, you know, how many movies are going to have about World War II? It's just a moment in time that is so just fascinating.
What do you think makes that time period endlessly fascinating? The fact that we're no cameras, it seems like a totally different world, but yeah, it's still recent enough to be like, dang, dude, like he still has a grandson alive, perhaps. Obviously, Ed Gein didn't procreate, but theoretically.
Yeah.
Ed Gein is just one of those fairy tale monsters to me that was just kind of also singular. He was singular because there was no true crime. Like, there was Pulp Fiction, but there was no, like, full-on, like, serial killer books like we have now, it feels like. Maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but it feels like he had no sense of reference to say, like, yeah, I should start making pussy chains. Like,
no,
I definitely need to do this.
He did. Well, I mean, his point of reference were the concentration camps, and the things that were supposedly, the things that were supposedly happening in the, like, you know, Elsa Koch and... You know, those types of people that were supposedly making lampshades and soap out of human skin.
It is that boogeyman kind of thing that keeps going from generation to generation. Like in the article you mentioned, when I was a kid, it wasn't Psycho. It was Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
Everyone went around and said, did you know that's based on a real guy?
Dude, they told me it was a documentary. I believed it the first time I watched it. I was like, this is filmed live.
So it was like, we all knew when I was a kid, we all knew who Ed Gein was because of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I guess if I could compare it to something, it's like the Universal Monsters, right? Like Wolfman, like it's all like they have all the monsters. All the monsters have been created. And Ed Gein is one of those true crime Universal Monsters. And I just wonder if what that fraternity of weirdos, what that looks like 20 years from now. If maybe there's an Ed Gein happening right now that we'll already be talking about.
If you're an Ed Gein, if you're email side stories, LPOTL at gmail.com. I want to know. I want to see your collection.
Do not contact
him. Well, I mean, one of the things about Gein, again, is that his crimes, you know, there's this image of the 50s, which to some extent is true, like all stereotypes. You know, this being very bland, kind of happy days, Leave It to Beaver, Eisenhower era, you know, and here in the midst of it, in, you know, small town USA, you know, there are all these unspeakable, incomprehensible horrors taking place inside this, again, middle American farmhouse. You know, it does seem like a real life fairy tale. You know, it's like, you know, I always tell people, in every
yes, it seems like a real
town.
Life fairy tale, Harold. That is, it is not a fairy tale.
Have you read fairy tales? A fairy tale, I'll tell you. You know, fairy tales.
Hansel and Gretel.
I know.
Well, let's say folk tale. You know, like in every small town, and even when I was growing up in the Bronx in my apartment building, you know, there's always, you know, all the kids are always telling tales. It's like Boo Radley, you know, in To Kill a Mockingbird. Yeah. You know, there's always one creepy house. Again, in my case, one creepy apartment, you know, where some cannibalist, you know, old hag lives or some creep. And, you know, in Gein's case, it turned out to be true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like this universal folk story, and it turned out to be true. And so that's part of the fascination.
And if there's one, I really do feel like if there's one, there has to be more. There has to have been more Ed Geins that didn't get caught. I really believe that you will bust into somebody's house that is foreclosed somewhere in this country, and you will find the same weird collection.
Well, I mean, I think what's really interesting about that time period in that area of the country is that, you know, I think it was, Harold, you did go through it in Deviant, is just how many, like, they blamed more murders on Ed Gein because so many murders were happening in this weird small area of Wisconsin. And also, like, at this time period, Charles Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugit's killing spree was, what, 2 years before, a year before, something like that? Like, the Midwest was wildly violent. And in this time period,
even when I went out to that area to do my research, I was told that area of Wisconsin had a higher per capita murder rate than New York City did.
Jesus, you know, that was right by my hometown. I didn't kill anyone, though.
He didn't.
So, anyway, you know, the other thing about the 50s, by the way, which goes back to my childhood. I'm like way older, obviously, than you guys. You know, it,
I don't see something. It.
Well, thank you. It's the gold lamé.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was, people don't realize, I mean, American pop culture was pervaded with horror stuff. I mean, I grew up, there was all this incredible horror stuff. You know, there were the EC horror comics.
Yeah.
There were all those, you know, that was the time when those Universal monsters are first being shown on TV. There were all these like Friday night creature feature shows, you know, yeah. And you'd go to the Saturday matinee, which back then cost a quarter. And, you know,
oh, tell me more.
And, you know, you'd see double feature of all these, you know, Roger Corman horror movies and The Incredible Shrinking Man and all that stuff. So, you know, there was a lot of horror stuff in the 50s. And again, all this emerging imagery of the death camps, which had so much influence on Gene's crime. So, you know, there was really a dark underside to the 50s. You know, I think that's one of the things that Psycho taps into, is this kind of duality of that period.
It seemed to be the shock and the PTSD from World War II. And no one really wanted to maybe talk about the fact that the entire world was embroiled in a conflict that ended with an atomic bomb being dropped on a bunch of people. You know, yep. It ended with fucking hundreds of thousands of people melting. So I think on some level, like, you legitimately, the entire world went through bullshit. And then we went through an economic boom. So in America, it was like, yeah, everybody go out and buy microwaves. We just made them. Mm-hmm. Don't want to talk about where they came from, but, you know, I mean, go buy them, you know, all this kind of shit. But you, like,
Maytag. So
it's these two, like, levels where it's economic prosperity mixed with a bunch of people who just, like, were killing people from the time they were 18 years old.
Yep.
I only have one small modification to make about your statement.
Please.
They didn't have microwaves back then.
Fuck.
There you go.
You've been Schechtered. Henry's been Schechtered. I actually am really surprised we haven't seen more modern Ed Gaines, especially during quarantine.
We've seen some TikTok videos. We've seen some TikTok videos that this are borderline.
This is some prime grave robbing time.
Absolutely. Again, thank you guys so much for being with us. Harold Schechter, Eric Powell, authors of Did You Hear What Eddie Gein Done? My last question is for both of you, Eric working with a more traditional author and Harold being more of a traditional author working in more of the graphic novel phase. We can start with Harold. What was that experience like? Was it different for you than writing a full novel? And what was that experience?
Yeah, it was great because Eric did most of the work.
That's what we're discovering as comic book writers. And you're like, you're writing, and you're like, well, hope you know how to decipher that.
So it was, from my point of view, an ideal collaboration. So.
Yeah, I had never worked on a nonfiction book before. So that was quite a leap for me. And I found out how easy it was to fall down a rabbit hole and try to, like, you know, chase one little bit of information until you've, you know, and sometimes to the point where it's like, I had to stop myself. This will never be in the book, you know?
Mm, right.
Yeah.
But it was amazing working with Harold. It's like, it's an experience I'll never be able to recreate, I'm sure, because I had the opportunity to work with one of my favorite authors. Mm. And if you've ever read a book and finished it and was like, oh, I'd love to ask that guy about this, you know, I got to do that every day.
Yeah.
And it was awesome.
That's awesome.
You know,
now you can call him all night.
Yeah.
Like, that's the best part. You have his number now. Yeah, you can call him and call him.
Yeah, what kind of stitch do you think he used?
Exactly. And then he'll be like, did you know in the 1950s they didn't have microwaves? You'd be like, we know. God. Well, awesome. Anything else, guys?
Harold, what you said you've been reading comic books forever. What are some of your favorites?
Well, it's a little bit of a painful subject for me.
Oh.
Because I had to sell my first mint condition 50 issues of Spider-Man mint condition to pay for my first divorce.
My goodness.
Oh, God, I feel it in my nervous system.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
But, I was actually an aspiring comic book artist myself. I actually applied for a job at Marvel Comics. I still have my rejection letter from Stan Lee's secretary. But yeah, I mean, I loved Steve Ditko. I have to say Steve Ditko is probably my favorite artist.
Nice.
I love Joe Kubert. I always love Sergeant Rock and Easy Company. I love Gil Kane's Green Lantern. Jack Kirby, of course. As Eric knows, I had until recently an original Jack Kirby Fantastic Four page, which I ended up auctioning off when I discovered how much it was worth, and I was too nervous to have it around my house.
Did that pay for the second divorce?
Yeah.
You got to save some of this for the second divorce, Harold. Honestly, I'm looking out for you, man.
So, yeah, I keep telling myself if I hadn't gotten divorced, you know, I wouldn't have had my children. I'd still have my comic book collection. And, you know, sometimes I'm not sure which one. Well, anyway.
And I suppose, Eric, same question for you.
I'm so busy right now that I kind of live in a cave when it comes to what's on the shelves. There's so much amazing stuff being done right now. We're really going through like another golden age of comics. And there's so much unique original material out there, not just the Marvel and DC stuff. There's so many awesome creators out there doing their own thing. It's kind of impossible to keep up with it, but I follow creators and I tend to buy whatever they do. Jeff Smith is a guy that I buy everything he does.
Yep.
Awesome. You know?
Yeah, man, I'm such a big fan of your work. Like I still like anytime we, and the way you approach everything too, like anytime we've ever gotten nominated for anything, I always think of Peaches Valentine. Like, when you got nominated for an Eisner, that is stuck in my head for decades of just and like
I think that's why I don't get nominated for Eisners anymore.
Well, it's to tell the page is that when Eric got nominated for an Eisner Award for The Goon, which the Eisner Award is the Oscars of comic books.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Yeah. No, he drew a character called Peaches Valentine, which is a man with a diaper full of shit, and he filled the diaper up with shit and then reached into the diaper and rubbed it all over his head and held up a sign that says Eisner Award nominee.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, man.
That was not a knock on the Eisners. It was a knock on myself I literally had a character in the book that played in his own shit and got nominated for the greatest award in comics. So
yeah,
it was awesome. More making fun of myself. But again, you know.
Yeah. That has stuck with me till this day.
But it helps. Stick,
yeah, it really does help.
Awesome. Henry, guys, anything else?
No, man, I'm just so happy to talk to you guys. Harold, you birthed us. How does that feel? Yeah. You did it.
How
made
does that
us.
Make you feel?
Yeah, no, thank you. I love talking to you guys. And by the way, I got to thank you guys for turning me on to Wolfenstein.
Oh, yes, bro.
The game is so dope. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. The name of the book is Did You Hear What Eddie Gein Done? Harold Schechter and Eric Powell. This was awesome. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you guys so much for having us.
So good to pick you guys' brain. Round of applause for all of us for the best interview we've ever done.
So humble.
Sometimes though, while it's good to remain humble, you also have to celebrate yourself.
A little bit. Well, thank you all so much for listening to this special episode of Blast Podcast on the Left. We hope you enjoyed it. And again, we love driving as much traffic as possible to move books for authors. And you guys are so great at helping authors survive in a world that's not freaking easy. Because believe it or not, writing isn't exactly a get-rich game. So thank you all so much for supporting these guys. Again, the name of the book, Did You Hear What Eddie Gein Done? Marcus, one thing you learned...
One thing that I learned, learned that things are not always what they seem, but
nice.
They can sometimes be what you think and also what you believe. And at the same time, being something that you don't really think, but also it's not what it seems always.
That's why I don't date. That is fantastic.
Wrapped it up. Harold Schechter, I learned, has tawny brown beautiful nipples.
Yes, he does. Okay, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Hail yourselves.
So we got live tickets. Go to lastpodcastontheleft.com. Get your live tickets. We are on tour. We're going to be out there. We have our comic book with DC coming out on October 5th. And if you go to lastpodcastmerch.com, you can buy our new coffee line. I know so. I saw a comment saying we've become the Kiss of podcasts, but I want you to understand that this is actually, Springlejack is a small little company, so all of this just kind of, it helps them too. It's like, it's a really cool opportunity and the coffee's delicious.
It's helping other people realize their dreams. So absolutely, please support small business people. We're not fucking, we're not doing Amazon brand coffee and then slapping our name on it. This is a small businessman that is realizing a dream of his own. And I would like everybody out there to support him as well. They work so fucking hard there.
And it's great. The coffee and the product's delicious. Coffee. It's so good.
And never forget God gave rock and roll to us. God gave rock and roll to everyone.
God gave rock and roll to you.
I will cry listening to that song. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Hail yourselves.
Hail Satan.
Oh, well, you know what? Yeah, I guess Hail Game. I guess Hail Game today. And also, if you want to get this book, try to buy it at your local comic book store. Please.
Yes, please.
Support your local comic book stores. And when our book comes out, also buy it at your local comic book store. Support local comic book stores. Always.
Absolutely.
Go request it, because then that helps them, because those are the people that need it. Amazon doesn't need it. Hail me, motherfuckers.
Magustalations, everyone.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.